anything?
I'm going to call this meeting of the Highlands Development Credit Bank to order. I would ask the members to introduce themselves so that we can have a roll call, please. Dale, if you would start, please.
Dale Davis. Ed Flipside.
Scott Wayneck from Morristown.
Ted Magliano.
John Weingart.
Susan Kraft.
Mike Halpin.
Okay, thank you. This meeting has been noticed with regards to the Open Public Meetings Act. It was posted on our website and published in the newspapers in accordance with the act. So at this time, I would ask anyone willing to stand and say pledge.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. I would ask someone to please accept the minutes from our last meeting on April 2nd. Do I have a motion?
So moved.
Second. Motion and a second. Any discussion on that? Any discussion from the public on that? Any comment? Hearing none. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstain?
Abstain.
Two abstentions. Do I have enough? Who abstained?
Ten.
Ten.
So five doesn't get right.
I got a question on that. If you read the minutes, what's your ruling?
Yes, you can
vote for it.
Yes.
Okay.
That's a good question.
Okay. I have nothing to report in particular. I just know that a lot of documents, well, some documents were sent out to everyone that Eileen will be reporting on today. We'll be talking about where we are right now in the process and where we hope to be within a couple months. So I thank everyone again for coming out, and we'll discuss our schedule also later on in the meeting. But is there anything, any questions right now for my report? Okay. Eileen, do you want to take us through the items that you have listed?
Yes, numbers 7 and 8 on the agenda are going to be handled through a PowerPoint, and Jeff and I will take different parts of it and go over these issues. And a lot of this is in response to a request from Scott to, now that we've spent a lot of time getting prepared, getting the board directors acclimated to the regional master plan, to the roles of the council and your own roles, Scott felt it was time that we gave an indication of what the future is, what the timing is, when certain things will start falling into place, and when the program really gets up and running, and how will that be handled. And so we've prepared this in the light of that request. Also, we'll be talking about certain elements of different programs, some that will be governed by the council, some by yourselves, and we'll tell you at which meetings there'll be further discussion. Today, a lot of it is as an overview for you, and we have a lot of documents out for public comment, so we wanted to have the benefit of that comment before you have lengthy discussions on it, because we will condense any comments received. You can have the full comments, and then a condensed report from us as your staff, so that you can read those and see what our responses are, and take that into consideration when you deliberate. So, with that in mind, we'll start the PowerPoint so everybody can see it. An overview of what we're going to cover through this PowerPoint is the Highlands TDR program timeline. That's one of the immediate things. The HDC, Highland Development Credit Bank, operating procedures, and then the long-term TDR program timeline, which actually takes us into through this year and into next year. We start with the short-term issues, what we're looking at the moment, and we'll elaborate on these as we go through it. Conservation restrictions, the language that we have for conservation restrictions that would be part of this program for those lands, those sending area lands. The HDC, Highlands Development Credit Allocation Determinations. There's two parts to this, a request for qualifications for a consultant, and I'll explain more about that in a few moments. And then something that you're familiar with at this stage, which is the web-based Highlands Development Credit Allocation Tool. That tool has to go through two processes. One is an internal process where we as a staff prepare that tool, prepare all the information that needs to be implemented or incorporated in the tool. And then we have to work with our consultant for our web-based platform, consultant Vertices. And so that tool should be ready for release for the public August of 2009, August of this year. And then the bank operating procedures also should be in place August 2009, provided you all have approved them at that meeting in August. So a little more elaboration on some of these issues. The TDR program conservation restrictions. We did draft conservation restriction language, and initially that was released for an informal public comment on April 17th. We received many comments on that draft release, and based on those comments, we revised the conservation restriction, and we separated the restriction into agricultural and non-agricultural uses. We did work in that interim period with the Department of Agriculture and with the Department of Environmental Protection to further coordinate with them in response to the comments received. Thus, we have posted revised draft conservation restrictions on our website June 3rd, that was yesterday, and we also did an agenda alert to let people know that they were up. So we're again taking public comment, and we'll continue to work with the Department of Ag and the Department of Environmental Protection, because they may have more comments and more work with us during that period. Public comment closes July 3rd, so we've left a significant amount of time there on this very important issue. And the Highlands Council may consider the conservation restrictions at its July 16th meeting. If board members have any comments on these as well, we ask you to have a look at those revised drafts online. Did we send them out
to those?
Sorry, they're in your packets today. And so we get those comments back to me, and again, staff will consider those and make sure that the council is aware of any comments you send. We did give you actually a folder today that has a lot of information in it as well, and takes you through the draft documents that again will help you in terms of the timeline that we're proposing today.
Eileen, comments submitted, Jeff, or to you?
You submit them through to me. I'll make sure that all of us will have a look at them, and I'll make sure that Jeff gets them, and he'll assist with writing the document for the council for their consideration. Now, I spoke earlier about a request for qualifications that we released. We released it on May 29th on our website. The Highlands Council is soliciting qualifications and supporting information from firms with expertise in all aspects of land use planning, including site development, site design, and securing local approvals. And to give you an idea of some of the issues that we want assistance from this consultant on, from a perspective of sending zone assistance, there are some very complicated issues which can't be addressed through our web-based tool, and we need to really have some extra assistance for the staff. For example, assisting in the confirmation of municipal zone designation, bulk standards, and for non-residential zones, parking requirements in specific municipalities as those requirements existed in August 2004. And that is because we have to have that information that predates the signing of the Act in order to move forward with the programme. Also, for non-residentially zoned parcels, we'll have to determine building footprint, gross floor area of pre-Highlands Act development potential consistent with the pre-Highlands Act state local environmental constraints. Again, these are very complex issues, and we don't have enough staff on board to do this kind of work and that kind of expertise. For receiving zone assistance, we're looking for a firm that would assist us in determining the Highlands Development Credit requirements to construct in TDR receiving zones through an assessment of receiving zone project pro formas and underlying market economics. And then one other issue, we sort of broadened the RFQ to also include potential to use this consultant to help us in all aspects of planning activities related to potentially approved Highlands redevelopment area projects. Again, because there's a tie-in for opportunities to use TDR. So we've put that up on the website on May 29th, and we will be looking for these firms to get back to us and for the council to approve a qualified firm so that we can have that assistance. An update on the status of TDR feasibility grants. We have 5 approved transfer development right feasibility grants. These are municipalities that approached us that want to look at the opportunity to possibly be considered receiving areas for transfer development rights. They do feasibility studies to make sure that they have the capacity to take on that extra density. Since we last spoke, Hopatcong Borough has submitted a grant application, which the council should consider at its June 25th meeting. And we've also been asked to give a presentation to Long Hill Township, which is within the 7 counties outside of the Highlands region. And they can be considered a receiving area. So Jeff, Tom and myself will go out to Long Hill Township and give that presentation in order to give them the information so that they can then decide whether they'd like to apply for the grant but already expressing interest.
Have you ever denied a grant to the town because you felt that they did not fit the criteria that you're looking for?
No, but what we have done is we've had pre-application meetings with towns to sort of guide them, and also what we have done is we've received submissions which we didn't feel adequately responded to the scope that we would advise them, and we thus advise them to increase their scope and take other things into consideration. Every municipality has done that, so every municipality to date has approved. Okay, as we move into discussing the Highlands Development Credit Bank operating procedures, just to give you again an overview of the process to date. We've drafted the HDC operating procedures based on similar procedures used by the State TDR Bank and the Pinelands Development Credit Bank. We released those for public comment on May 26th. They went up on the website. The public comment closes June 26th, so they accept comments up to that day and on that day, June 26th, 2009. Again, we've left a long amount of time here to get adequate public comment because we feel that's terribly important and it's consistent with the approach taken for our regional master plan. The Highlands Development Credit Bank staff then will revise the draft operating procedures in response to those comments and provide a summary of comments and responses to the bank so that they consider that, and we would expect that that would be considered by the bank at their August meeting, at your August meeting. At this point, I'll hand it over to Jeff to take you through the detailed description of the bank operating procedures.
Thank you very much, Annie. As Eileen mentioned, based on the previous slide, the draft looked significantly at the State TDR Bank regulations and also the PDC Bank regulations for framing the operating procedures, the draft operating procedures for the HDC Bank. Language is very similar, probably more similar to what you find with the PDC rules, because of the fact that it's would be a sister regional bank. I'm just going to go through most of and highlight most of the significant areas within the operating procedures. The purposes are: let's establish an efficient and effective method for documenting the sale, transfer, conveyance, and use of credits, which are allocated pursuant to the policies under the regional master plan. And then to facilitate the operation of the Highlands TDR program through the bank's participation and purchase and sale of HDCs, through the tracking of HDCs, and the like. You'll also see in section 1 the applicability, severability provisions that you often see in these types of operating procedures. And section two are the definitions, and they speak for themselves, so I'm not going to go through those. Section three lays out the duties and responsibilities of both the board with respect to the operating procedures and the bank's executive director. The board of directors reaffirms that the board of directors is the governing body of the bank and bears the ultimate responsibility for implementing and enforcing the provisions of the operating procedures. The other primary responsibility is that the board shall adopt and revise the form and content of an HDC certificate. We have a sample draft that's also included in your binders today. The executive director serves as the administrative officer of the board, puts in place any administrative procedures and forms that are necessary to implement the role of the bank and bank operations, and actually issues their certificate and maintains all records of the bank, which includes the Highlands Development Credit Registry, which is essentially the database that could be tracking the conveyances of credits throughout the system. Section 4 deals with the Highlands Development Credit Certificates. We'll just lay out some of the primary areas there. No person may sell, transfer, convey, or encumber any Highlands Development Credit or any interest therein without first getting a HDC certificate from the bank. So essentially, if you receive an allocation determination from the Highlands Council, that allocation itself does not mean that you have credits that you can turn around and sell or convey or transfer to someone else. You have to go the next step, which is getting a certificate from the bank. And there's, again, an application for a certificate in your binder.
Yes. Can we ask questions?
Sure.
That isn't interpreted to mean normal property loans and conveyances of land prior to someone, getting an HDC determination? I mean, it says that they can't encumber the credits in any way without obtaining a certificate from the bank.
I think they mean, so like you can't use it as collateral until you have the certificate. You always can borrow against your house, but you can't borrow against the value of that certificate.
But if somebody goes to a bank to get a loan, for whatever purpose, the bank's going to look at the value of the property, oh, you're entitled to credits. I mean, people are going to give loans out there to properties in the sending area that in part are based on a calculation of their worth, whether we like it right or not. So I'm just wondering what's really intended here. Because before the credit's created, it doesn't really exist, right?
Well, I mean, the credit themselves arguably isn't created until you actually have a certificate in hand and you've placed that conservation restriction on your property.
Right, that's why I don't really understand how that first sentence is worded there. So maybe just a point of discussion, or, you know, we can talk about it later.
Doesn't this certificate just kind of finalize everything and just make sure all the T's are crossed, the I's are dotted?
The line and the bottom line is if you have been, if you have received an allocation determination from the council, the fact that you have that doesn't mean that you have saleable credits. The only way you can have saleable credits is if you've actually gone and recorded the conservation restriction, which now means you've forever severed any development potential that you would have had related to the property, based on pre-Highlands Act development potential.
Well, plus there's always a possibility of another transaction that could take place where we just act as the clearinghouse, that a buyer and a seller could come together privately and enter into a contract with it just temporarily passing through us. And maybe that is the language that will protect that contract from actually taking place until the certificates take place. This way we don't have a buyer or a purchaser going to a town planning board saying, I've bought some credits from that person who wasn't discussing, that person really wasn't allowed to enter into that contract. So it protects that.
The bottom line of the language here is to basically say, you cannot transfer, encumber, sell, convey any credits until you have a certificate, which means now the bank is certified that there's an appropriate deed restriction recorded against that property. That's the purpose of that question.
But wouldn't the, what would it hurt, let's say somebody owns a piece of property, and of course we know their development rights are harmed. If they don't want to sell the rights to you, but they want to know how many development credits they could possibly get, does the encumber word mean that they can't go to a bank to loan them money to buy a tractor or whatever and say, oh, well, you know, if you take this property, you'll probably be able to get this money. There's no guarantee here.
Well,
actually preserving it or whatever.
I mean, what you have the situation is once you've received a formal allocation determination from the council, that's how many credits the property is entitled to receive. You're basically not perfecting those credits to be able to sell them until you've received a certificate, which means you've recorded the conservation restriction. Short of getting the certificate, you do have this allocation letter which says, if you go ahead and take these following steps and perfect the credits that you've allocated, you will be able to then sell, transfer, convey, or encumber. So it basically allows a property owner who says, at this point, I don't want to put a conservation restriction on my property. I want to see what's going to happen in the credit market, but I would like a formal determination from the council as to how many credits my property is entitled to receive. You receive that allocation determination, and it remains valid for 3 years. And you can choose not to go forward and submit an application to get a formal certificate from the bank and not place the conservation restriction on your property. So it gives a little bit of flexibility to the property owner as to what point in time they now want to perfect their credits that they've been allocated. It's just another step. And this is exactly the way that the Pinelands, you know, proceeds, the PDC bank proceeds in their operations.
Yeah. These TDRs you're indicating can be pledged for a loan at a bank. That's correct? What is the liquidity of them from the bank's perspective?
That's going to be for the bank's determination. I mean, you know, the issue about the value of the credits will depend on the demand for those credits.
And that's going to be a guarantee of demand.
So in effect, though, what is their value then from a liquidity standpoint? And what is their value as collateral then when the farmer wants to go to the bank to place those TDRs? Because if there's no liquidity in them,
it's like an initial public walk. I mean, we're told you take the first step, and then I think we'll have a better sense, and the banks will have a better sense once this program gets up and running. There's no guarantees.
But the landowners can come to the bank and seek that from the bank. They can seek a guarantee of a certain minimum value for purposes of collateral.
The extent that the bank has the
funds to support it.
Right. The bank has the funds to support it to be able to guarantee.
Which isn't a guarantee.
There's no guarantee of the value of their house. If they're pledging their home, the value of their home could fluctuate and go up and down. Yeah. There are no absolutes.
Well, I understand that.
Well, we would be certifying that their credit is worth what a credit is worth. A market will determine what a credit is worth, but we'll certify you have six credits.
We have a language that sets a basis. Right. We have language that talks about moving that basis for up.
Where prior to receiving the certificate, they have no, that landowner has no way of fixing any kind of value to a credit. By getting certified, he now can certify, I have six credits on this piece of property. What the credit's worth, you know, depends on, you know, it's
any other monetary instrument,
you know.
In my head, it's be anything. It's the goal is to be a stock.
You're saying that TDR expires in 3 years or something?
No, the allocation determination that's issued by the council, how many credits is this property entitled to receive, is good for 3 years. because we want to ensure that if there's any change in circumstance over the course of those 3 years, we may have to re-examine whether, you know, if someone built an exemption, for example, then they wouldn't be entitled to, you know, an additional credit or whatever the case may be. So we don't want it to have to go on indefinitely.
But the certificates are good.
Certificates, once these certificates are issued, they're good indefinitely because they're now secured by the deed restriction on the property.
Okay.
So when a property owner wishes to obtain a certificate from the bank, they will submit an application that includes information about the property owner, parcel itself, the HTC allocation that the property received by the Highlands Council. It also requires a copy of the deed and the draft conservation restriction must also be filed with the application so that the bank staff can certify that the conservation restriction will in fact restrict the future development of the property, and then the owner can, upon approval of the bank, and then record that restriction, and then the certificate will be issued. The certificate also will only be issued if the property owner has marketable title, is legally empowered to restrict the use of the property, and the restriction filed with the application prohibits the future development of the property in perpetuity. And then once issued, that certificate and the credits associated with that certificate may be sold, transferred, and recovered, and then ultimately redeemed by the purchaser for use in the receiving zone. This is a draft certificate, which you will find in your binders, and it lays out the basic information required by the operating procedures to be included, including the property owner's name, the number of HTCs that they were allocated, the block and lot of the property, and where the information is recorded on the booking page of the county clerk's office.
So only a title landowner can receive a credit certificate.
Yes. Because they have to have the authority to recover the property. Under Section 5 is the procedures regarding the Highlands Development Credit Registry. This is basically the tracking mechanism for transactions related to Highlands Development Credits. It will track the issuance, sale, transfer, use, and redemption of all HTCs. It must list the name and address of every HTC certificate owner, the date of its issuance, all relevant property information, and the number of HTCs allocated to the property, along with the acreage of the property, so we know how much is actually being deed-restricted. The registry has to be available for public inspection, and the idea will be to eventually have the registry up online, such that information about the number of certificates and credits that are available are there without ensuring a violation of privacy concerns. Under this provision, the executive director is also responsible for preparing an annual report by March 30th of every year that discusses the bank's activities for the preceding year, and the reports provided to the governor, the Highlands Council, the legislature, and then every county and municipality within the Highlands region. Purchase of Highlands Development Credits, an important function of the bank, particularly in this initial period. A property owner wishing to sell their Highlands Development Credits to the bank must complete an application that will include the name, property information, allocation, certificate, serial number, the number of HTCs being offered, and the sale price being offered per HTC. The board may purchase credits where the purchase will either further the objectives of the Highlands Act and the Regional Master Plan, or it's to alleviate a demonstrated unique and extenuating financial circumstance, i.e. a hardship case. Where the purchase is to alleviate a hardship, the owner must demonstrate that the investment in the land to which the credits are allocated is substantial in relation to their net worth, and that the owner is experiencing an extraordinary financial hardship, which may only be ameliorated through the expedient sale of Highlands Development Credits. As staff has framed the operating procedures for your consideration, it's based trying to truly get at what are those hardship cases? Who are those property owners who have been most significantly affected, where the sale of credits is necessary because it's the only way that they can alleviate financial strain that they're basically under. They're facing imminent bankruptcy. They've had a loss of a job and have been out of work for a number of months. They have extraordinary medical expenses, and normally they might try to sell off a lot on their property. Prior to the Highlands Act, it would have been something that they would have tried to do. In this case, they're trying to sell credits again to generate funds to be able to satisfy or help deal with a dire financial situation. The operating procedures also give priority consideration for purchase to those properties where the HDCs are offered at less than the price established by the bank. The idea being the ability for the bank to stretch its funds as much as possible. If there are property owners who are willing to sell credits at less than whatever the value established by the bank, that the bank would place that as part of the priority. And priority is also given to those properties that just missed qualifying for Exemption 3 under the Highlands Act, which is essentially a grandfathering provision, because they did not receive a necessary state land use permit, but they had an administratively complete application pending before the DEP for such permit. And this is a requirement under the Highlands Act. So this is where that the second priority comes from. It's an actual requirement under the TDR section of the Highlands Act.
Is that a permanent requirement?
It's a statutory
requirement. It's a statutory requirement.
But it's permanent.
Until the legislature modifies the
statute. Somebody had an application pending on land use in 2004. Will have a perpetual.
Okay. As currently drafted in the operating procedures, the price established for an HDC is $16,000. However, the board may adjust the purchase price if it determines that the adjusted price will not substantially impair the private market.
Can we just clarify
that
when Ralph was asking about the Exemption 3? Those property owners would have applied for exemption number 3 and been denied. So there is a select list available to us. If anybody wants to be added on, let's go through that process with the department. But really, the department already has taken action on this, and there was a limited amount of time in which certain work had to be done on the site to be allowed that exemption. And if they failed, they were given a notice. So that those are they that will be allowed to. That we have to prioritize according to the Act. But it is a limited number.
So it's not, okay, so they had a project in progress.
And they had to have
yes.
local
and
approvals.
And they had applied for a land use permit, and they had local approvals. They didn't have a state approval. All right, so we are dealing with a... It's not like someone's going to show up tomorrow and say, look at all my plans.
Yeah. Right, and that's what I was concerned with, to qualify that for you and make sure we clarify the answer.
All right.
Section 3, I guess, talks about the hardship has four criteria, which all have to be met. Okay, so I'm wondering what the value of the third one is. The fourth one says there has to be a unique and extenuating circumstance that can only be ameliorated through the credit. The third one says you have to show that the credits are substantial in relation to the property owner's net worth. The fourth one's met. It seems like the third one would be unnecessary.
I'm sorry, John, what page?
Page 12, number 3.
Number 3, criteria C. Sure.
The relationship between C and D is that under C, number one, the credits themselves in relation to the owner's overall net worth is substantial. But simply because of that fact, if there's not other extenuating circumstances...
Right, and that's the flip side. If it meets D, what would be the situation under which we turn it down because it didn't meet C?
I imagine if, let's imagine bankruptcy is the extraordinary circumstance, but their net worth is extraordinary compared to the land value worth.
But
so
they're showing that it could really be the only way to solve the problem is the sale. Well,
I think it's a good point. Is the deed finishes with which may only be ameliorated, which implies that it's the only avenue. So I think that's something we'll take under consideration.
Yeah, and on that same point, what was meant by the word investment? You know, the investment in the land, which are you talking about? What they originally invested, what it's worth now, what the basis of the land is now, what, you know, what are you trying to get?
It was meant what your current investment itself today in relation to the value of the credits, not their initial investment.
So we need to clarify that
as
well.
Actually, now glad you brought that up. That's an and clause, so the hardship definition is C and D.
Correct.
What does investment in land mean? What if you have a zero basis capital owner who's been the owner of the property forever?
Right.
Somebody somewhere, actually depending how far back they go, nobody may have ever paid for the land. What is investment? How does that get defined? What if you have a zero basis owner who, but they're broke and their wife is going into a nursing home and he needs to sell the credits, but he has no investment ratio to his net worth?
I think that what we're going to do is clarify the use, perhaps the use of the word investment was not the correct one.
I also want to clarify why it says in relation to her net worth. That might be something we might want to correct.
Come on, another
proof of email
application. That's what it says. Ralph, if you look at the definitions, there's a description. It answers them. The description is about masculine and feminine.
Could just be changed to the owner.
The other question on D is, this is a unique and extenuating circumstance which may only be ameliorated through expedient sale of credits. Now, if someone comes in and they're really financially in need, there's no question, are we saying, we can sell property, that's an alternative, or is it, they don't have anything else to sell but the property and the credits, we're saying, then that qualifies you. Then you would. So we may want to clarify here that we're not talking about sell your property, that's the solution to your problem, right?
Yes.
Okay.
I guess we do not intend to exclude people without an actual cash investment, right?
That's correct.
Because they're not excluded from hardship automatically.
What's the burden of proof for all this? I mean, what are we going to require? How deep are we going to have to delve into someone's finances to satisfy these conditions? I mean, it seems like you could take it on face value, or you could really want to dig deeply into someone's personal life. What is the cutoff? What is the threshold of information? Where's the burden of proof? How is that fulfilled?
I mean, the burden of proof is certainly on the applicant. Excuse me. Whatever documentation they want to submit, if they're going to submit bank records, appraisal report, if they have that in the value of the property. I mean, basically any documentation or record evidence that they can give us to support their claim that they're in hardship. I mean, we really want to be addressing only those property owners that are in a hardship situation. And something short of saying you have to provide some record evidence of what your current financial situation is, and just taking it on good faith, as much as we would like to be able to do that, I don't think is prudent.
That's true, but if you make it too, if you make the process too invasive, you might discourage people from doing it because, I don't know, it can get kind of personal. You're looking at all of their assets.
Sure.
So when you want them to submit a personal financial statement?
I actually don't see how you could do it without seeing their tax return.
But the tax return is a yearly snapshot.
Not only the tax return, but I'm saying you would need to see that tax return. So yeah, that hardship applicant is voluntarily producing a lot of private information.
And that's a key word, Ralph, voluntarily. Yeah. Because they're coming to us asking
community. They're looking for a hardship
at the top of the pile. Yeah. Perhaps we have to hold them to some level of participation on their part and sharing that type of information. We're asking for relief from us, and we're going to have to tell what we're looking for.
Yeah. So you know before they do.
Yeah, it's a very good question, and we'll flesh it out a little bit more. But I agree that it's necessary.
If we can just back up a little and tell you why we're doing this, the Act mandated that we look at those that had applied for exemption number 3 and had just missed it. So that's requirement of the Act. In the Regional Master Plan, the Council, knowing the difficulties of this program and the limited nature currently due to the fact that we don't have receiving zones, wanted to make sure that those who are most adversely affected had the first opportunity to apply for credits. So I just wanted to make sure you understood the background of this. And thus, we're now working with you, and it will be ultimately you that will decide on those hardship cases and what you need to see in order to determine that in that first offering who gets those that opportunity.
I think we need to take as much subjectivity out of it as possible. The only way you can do that is to set a certain criteria and so I don't know what else you can do.
If you could come up with certain criteria and set it to us, it would help us or help you in terms of getting to that August date when you want to approve these procedures to make sure that you have enough information on that and that we have enough information so that we can make those determinations.
Does Pine Lands or someone else offer criteria? No.
In terms of priority, this whole section says we can buy credits when we have enough money and that we're not going to substantially impair the market. But there's sort of a catch-all is C, the purchase will result in all of these with advancing the Highlands Plan impacts, right? That's kind of category one of reasons to buy. Okay. Category two is financial hardship. Category three is bargain sale, and category four seems to be the permit. Now, I don't see priority being given to hardship like priorities being given to the bargain sale and the permit. Is that by design, or I guess my thought is, let's say we decide to buy credits and we get lots of applications. How would we prioritize them? And it seems to me hardship should probably be the top of the list. That's the first thing we should be trying to relieve is those really hard hardships, right? So that's kind of a general comment on this section. Saying priority to some of these aspects, not priority to others, and there's no relatively. So, I mean, maybe we'll be lucky if we get a cascade of applications to sell credits in about them. But if we do, we need some objective way of prioritizing.
Okay, and I think we can certainly provide some clarification on that. And I think the slide that I think is going to talk about later will kind of clarify how we're perceiving where hardship fits in relative to the other criteria.
Yeah.
If there are any other questions relative to this slide, if not, I'll move back on. With respect to the sale of Highlands Development Credits, this section of the operating procedures is modeled very much so on the Highlands procedures. And I'll just again highlight some of the more substantive aspects of it. From time to time, the board may authorize the executive director to sell any credits that are owned by the bank, provided there's sufficient interest in the purchase of the credits to warrant a sale, and that the timing of sale of the HDCs will not substantially impair the private sale of the private market. All sales authorized by the board will be conducted in open bidding through a public auction or by closed bidding through the received sealed agreement bids. Notice of the pending sale must be published in the bank's newspapers and records, and notice must be provided to every person who had submitted a previous written request to the bank to be informed about upcoming sales. The credits that are owned by the bank, when sold through either auction or closed bidding, will be sold to the highest bidder or bidders, and generally the purchase must be completed within 30 days of the award of the credits. This last provision, where the board authorizes the executive director to convey credits at no cost, is for
the fact on the bidding process.
Certainly.
Does that mean that the open bid would have to be $16,000 when you sell?
The bank can, I can double check the back myself, but I believe the minimum acceptable bid would be whatever the amount that the bank has said they were going to offer to purchase credits at. So if you look on page 15 under C2, currently it says the minimum accepted bid shall be $16,000. So there's a relationship between the two.
Jeff, on that point, on page 13, we have, we're in purchasing.
Yes.
And so the purchase price will be 16, and then it says we may adjust the price if we determine that we need to not substantially impair the credit on our case. Shouldn't that say shall? I mean, because on the corresponding point is page 15, number 2, that you just referred to, which says the minimum bid will be 16, however, if you think it's higher, then we'll make it higher. I'm just trying to get to whether the intention of the board is to be buying them at market value and selling them at market value. Aside from prioritizing the guys that are selling to us for less than they're worth, shouldn't we be taking kind of the same approach in this section?
That's the intention.
Okay.
I mean, what if we get a bargain sale? Somebody in part, I would give it, let me add, in the hardship cases, would we give ranking to bargain? Somebody who's saying, this is what I need, and I'll sell my credits, or?
If you had two property owners that both were in a similar hardship situation, one was offering their credits for sale less than whatever then the rate the bank was offering, yes, they would receive priority based on the way that those
are. Right, but we should be able to sell that credit at the market.
Yes. At whatever the going rate establishment is.
All right, then I misunderstood your answer, because I thought you were saying that what we buy it at will determine what we do.
No, what I meant was whatever the bank has established as its purchase price, that credits would be sold at auction.
Even if we actually pay less?
If we pay less than what we sell, so that we could create a recurring. To the extent that happens, then obviously that money could be followed up.
So the question, the answer is yes, right? Should the may, should be shall? Shall, yes.
Well, I think it should be left may in that we wanted to ensure that the bank had flexibility. I mean, what happens if, let's just assume the purchase price is $16,000 and 2 years from now we recognize that they're being sold on the private market at $11,000 each, and we're offering a purchase at $16,000, so there might be the need to adjust downward. I guess I didn't need to think about
it.
Well, no, I mean, under the purchase price provision, it's may adjust, and it doesn't say only up, it doesn't say only down. It's meant to give the bank flexibility to look at what's happening in the market and be able to adjust that price where appropriate.
So you're saying you can change this, what's written here?
Yeah.
I see. I mean, the main premise is that if we ever have a private market that's fully functioning, the bank won't undersell it. That's the point, right?
Yes.
That's
whatever language we need, that's the main thing. If the bank holds credits because we're overpriced, that's fine. But we can never actually undersell if there's an active credit market going. We can't undersell that market because we need to keep the lights on or something.
Right,
that's what should be the stated policy.
But on the corresponding other side, in terms of purchasing, the market of credits out there is $50,000 of credit, and somebody comes in with a hardship, we shouldn't be sitting here saying we still have the right to buy the credit at 16. We should be paying market value, right?
Well, that person has the right to decide to sell the credit.
Yeah. If there's a hardship.
There's a hardship case, you should.
But if the market's carrying $50,000, then that person should. That means that there should be an opportunity to go sell it at $50,000 other than the bank.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Sell it for $45,000.
Right.
Well,
the bank doesn't always have to be the purchaser by any means.
Yeah, that'd be nice, but we're looking at.
And initially they are.
Yeah,
that's
right. I mean, I could see a hardship applicant.
Which is why the market isn't going to be $50,000. While the bank's the only buyer.
A hardship applicant would make a bargain because he needs the cash. And he wants to make sure that
there
they
won't be
marks.
The disparity that Susan's talking about. Until someone other than the bank is buying, 16 is going to be the world we live in.
Right, but as I mean, if you watch what happened in the Pinelands, right, there was some very low number got set at the base beginning, and it took a long time, right, and then values went up, and the you know, and the real estate market's going to go up and down and up and down, and so okay, so it went up, it was great, and it came down, and credits weren't worth as much, but if a hardship, you know, applicant comes in, they shouldn't be paid some, you know, 3-year-old, 5-year-old, 10-year-old number if the market since then has become something substantially more.
Right. Well, under the PDC bank rules, Susan, I mean, they're required, when they are going to make a purchase, they can only purchase a bit. Maybe some of us can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it's only 80% of whatever the then going market rate is. And so when they reevaluate every so many years their minimum credit price, that's what they base their assessment on. They look at the historical trend over the last, let's say, 3 to 5 years, and they look at, they say, this is what the established market is, and they're going to pay 80%, and that's what they write into their rules. So I think most recently...
Most recently they moved it to 18 or something, and you know, I argued then, too. Mm-hmm. I didn't think we should be locking into a regulation in that case. Regulation, what the purchase price is going to be. I said, what are we kidding? This should be able to flow, you know, with the market.
Well,
and
what,
come back and amend regulations.
Right. I mean, what the second provision was intended to do is to give this board flexibility to address situations that we can't foresee right now as we move forward with the program. And so that was left as many for that purpose. As opposed to it must adjust it. You know, must always go up because there will be situations where it may not make sense and they have to adjust it down. And that's why I left it in there. But, you know, I'll certainly consider it and we'll discuss it and think of whether
we can move on. We're going to change, take away higher and change it to different or whatever. The board will have the leeway to lower its minimum acceptable bid. You know, you want to leave it as may, which I understand, I think, but it's up or down, but it's not, that's what you said. Mm-hmm. You didn't mean for it to say higher.
Well, basically, if the bank establishes that you know, they're now going to be purchasing at $25,000 of credit on page 15, that minimum acceptable bid would be whatever the bank has established in this, under the purchase price. So we would have to amend that section as well. But I can write it such that it floats. On page 15, it could read, the minimum acceptable bid shall be whatever the bank establishes as the purchase price under F1.
And the scenario could occur where we have a sending zone market that's suddenly, you know, a single project, and we want to stimulate it. So we want to sell below the credit line. But the bank might want to have that discretion to do that. You know what, preclude that. Yeah, we'd like to do that, but the language is we can't. Wishful thinking.
But with respect to the conveyance of credits at no cost, the purpose for this provision is that there could be situations where, let's say, for example, a municipality would like to locate 100% affordable housing in one of the TDR receiving zones. And the only way that they can proceed through that is because, first, they don't have housing development credits at their disposal. They could come to the bank and request from the bank that those credits be conveyed to the municipality for purposes of developing the supportable housing project, if that's what the municipality wanted to do, so that they could complete that project. And that's, in essence, what this last provision is trying to do. If there are situations where municipalities or even possibly nonprofits have projects in receiving zones where they don't have credits, they don't have the capital or ability to acquire credits to build at an increased density or intensity, and they're looking to the bank to help them move that public project forward.
Are the examples you're thinking of here limited to affordable housing projects?
They're not. It's just, I think that's probably the one that most people could understand.
And would construction of an affordable housing unit require an HDC?
It can require a credit, but under the Act, we just can't impose impact fees with respect to that.
But who would... I mean, the rest of the state talking about TDR and COA, the kind of underlying assumption in most of those discussions is that if you're building an inclusionary development, it's most likely that all of the affordable units are not going to require credit to be built. Is that the same approach that Highlands Council is kind of thinking about here?
Here we were just looking for an example, and Jeff had a different one earlier. We were talking about perhaps 100% affordable project that a town wants to do and wants to increase the density and might use this, and we thought more state goals were being achieved through this process and they might have the opportunity to appeal for this. This apparently is available under the TDR and the PDC bank. It has never been used, but we didn't want to not have that possibility for you to consider this. The example Jeff had earlier was a fire station being built.
So let's say a new firehouse needed to be built. It's going to be constructed within the receiving zone, but the intensity of that use was greater than what the underlying ordinance was going to allow. So the municipality would come to the bank, because it doesn't have credits readily on hand, to be able to move forward on that project. So that's the intent.
Why wouldn't the municipality just change the zone then?
Well, the thing is that these are municipalities, let's say a municipality that's already conformed to the regional master plan has established what the zoning is going to be. Now they have a situation where 10 years down the road or 5 years down the road, they've recognized they need to either upgrade their existing fire station or whatever. That's what this is intended to try to do, and maybe it's be more artfully drafted.
I forgot that. Okay.
This section really... I'm a little worried about this.
Okay.
I think we have a very big hill to climb in front of us to create a market for credits. And I think the last thing we should be saying is finding ways to allow development to happen, or not even development happen without credits, but giving credits away for nothing. And I think that is a very, very substantial step for the bank to take. And I think we better think long and hard before we put anything in our guidelines or regulations that promote, encourage, acknowledge, whatever, the sale, quote-unquote, of credits from this bank for nothing. Because I think that's going to be eroding the trust and the confidence of all the people out there that are looking to us to do the opposite, which is to find ways to build value for credits, not to give them away. I think a better way to address that may be through the plan and through conformance, that if you have a church or you have a school or whatever, you have these public buildings that are necessary, maybe you deal with it in the plan by saying you don't need credits to build in the receiving area for these kinds of structures, and you put it to bed that way. I'm just worried that the development community will try to exploit this and come in and claim that they can't build an inclusionary development without getting credits for nothing, because they will, you know. And if we open that door, I think we're going to get a lot of takers on this argument, and I don't think that's what it should be.
You can get rid of the whole section if you want, so maybe that's something.
Well, it's a very good point. Maybe one way to tighten it up would be to define what public purpose is, compelling public purpose.
What were you thinking?
We have to put it in the budget.
Just that the PDC had this model and it seemed like a plan, or did you have...
There wasn't a specific project or situation that we had in mind.
Imagine the COA type thing.
No, it was a recognition that the PDC did have this provision in there. And there are probably situations that we can't foresee right now, particularly given conformance and policy moving forward, where there could be, you know, legitimate public purpose, where the credit requirement could somehow render the project unable to move forward. That was the purpose.
I see what she's saying about a developer and you know, just coming in the door all the time with, you know, that thing, I need to be a co over here. And I think the town's the same way. I would not put it past any town to look at anything the Highlands is giving away to try to take advantage of it, going even as far as what we talked about earlier, money for studies for the town. They may not do anything, but you're giving a lot of free stuff, and it may be getting used for other purposes.
Well, just for one point of clarification, the conveyance at no cost can only go to a governmental agency or not-for-profit, as they currently do. Certainly, I guess, the development community could try to make some analogous argument, but as it's drafted, that's the only entities that could receive that.
See, now here's what I thought you were going to say when I asked you what you had in mind. That you have a developer in a receiving zone who has a certain unit capacity and is going to buy X number of credits to get the unit capacity above the allowable zoning. And the town or the county come in and say, we want a COA component in this development. And he says, great. I'll go below the market on 10% of my units, but you can't actually expect me to pay for the credits to add sub-market units. And therefore, you want to have the ability to give them those credits so that the town doesn't say, well, we'll just strip the whole thing and give them the zoning variance. And now we're in a war with the municipality over a zoning variance they're not supposed to have given out in the receiving district at its Highlands Council Bank versus COA, which is the delightful headline that we can all
to make sure that that happens.
So that is a scenario I thought you were trying to defend against, because that has happened in a lot of towns, obviously not in the TDR concept, but where developers have come in and they've asked for breaks because you're asking them to add a component of sub-market housing. And if they don't get the break, it's fine. We're not going to do the below-market housing. Just leave me alone. But if you need me to do 10 or 15% COA, you have to help me do that. And then we turn around, it happens to be an ascending district, a receiving district, sorry, and he turns and says, what, and I have to buy credits on top of that? And we want to accommodate them because we don't want to tempt the town to go back on their zoning agreement when they established the receiving district.
We create a model where the only way to get a successful inclusionary development built in a receiving area is by the bank giving you credits for nothing, then we've just inserted ourselves into every inclusionary receiving area, which we don't want to be in.
Yeah, but the public benefit bar isn't that low. It's not like every builder can come in and make a public benefit claim. It's not that easy to do.
For inclusionary development? For low and mod housing?
Well, that's it, yeah. For low and mod housing, that's the public benefits. But you said every developer. I mean,
every developer of low and mod housing.
Yeah, well.
Is one to be coming here and sucking credits out of the bank for no money, in which case we've lost our ability to recycle funds. You know, we don't, don't think we'll insert ourselves into that circle if we can get it.
No, certainly not the intention.
We need our money.
Right.
We'll never get our money back.
Okay, Jeff, moving on.
Well, so what are we going to do with that? Are we just going to jettison the whole thing?
No, we're going to, as we examine comments that come in and as we deliberate on this over the next month.
Oh, okay, so we'll have to finish that.
No. And with that, this concludes kind of my overview of the current draft of the operating procedures. And with that, I'll turn it back to Eileen for the last several slides.
As we close out on the bank operating procedures, what I'd like to ask you to do, though, is given that we've had the first real discussion here, if you have ideas or comments that you want to send to us, please do. If you could consider getting them to us within the next week, because then Jeff can start revising them and he can either send out something that shows you some of the comments we heard here today and the issues that have been raised. As Jeff prepared these, he wanted to look at what was available through the TDR Bank and through the Highlands Bank, and offer you the full range of what they offer for you to make your decisions. So he didn't want to, and you know, we discussed this, he didn't want to say this is good, bad, or indifferent. He wanted to offer this for you to make your determination. It's something that's already available in the state in another program. And again, it's you have the ability to authorize this through this section, should you so desire. But you will guide us as to what you want in that end, in your procedures at the end. But we want to make sure we gave you the full scope of what's available already in other programs, and then see where we end up with on this. But for us to take this out and not offer it to you for your consideration is making decisions for you. So we're giving you everything that's available elsewhere and ask that you sort of then decide how you want your procedures to end up. So if you could consider getting back to us, that would help us. In getting some of this changed and redrafted, we'll get it back out to you, and then we'll, as Scott said, we'll take comments, get those comments back out to you, so by the time we sit together in August, you will have had the opportunity here to consider further comments from yourselves, which we'll make sure we get out to you, and then the public comments. So the benefit of all of those, so that you make your final determination in August. Is that okay?
Ms. Morris, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so my notes are over
to you. This is the last slide. And really now, this is just to bring things back into perspective. I'll back up a little and put the whole thing together in terms of the timeline. So as we spoke about at the beginning of the PowerPoint, the conservation restriction language should be determined by the council and finalised at their July meeting. Again, after public comments have been reviewed, your own comments to us, if you have any, please, we'll make sure the council gets them. They make that determination in July, at which point then we'll know what the conservation restriction language is. The consultant we spoke about hiring, that will occur in July, will be very critical from the perspective of allocations to help us in particularly with non-res development potential that is available on a site-by-site basis prior to the Act. So again, that consultant will be on board to help us with the allocations. The operating procedures approved by this body in August of 09 as well. And also the HDC allocation tool, that web-based tool available to the public in August 09. And that gets us ready then for what you see on this slide, allocation determinations. Once that web-based tool is up, landowners and interested parties in the Highlands can start using it to get some idea of what the allocation, how many credits would be available on their property. Then they move into the next process, which is you need a certificate and an application. So in general then people, the public could be asking for an allocation determination from the council. You will approve that certificate and that application in August of 2009. And then back to what Jeff referred to in terms of the hardship. Given the regional master plans dictate that the that we prioritize and look first at those hardship cases, what the staff are recommending to you in terms of this timeline is that the first offering, so to speak, in terms of the TDR program would be for hardship sale of HDCs. And the council, the board, could consider that doing that September 15th. So the tool has been available, allocations can be made and determined, and then an open period for 3 months for hardship sale first. So at that point we get the materials in, and whatever it is, whatever that criteria is to determine those hardships and to help you determine which of those should move forward, the consideration of that hardship sale by yourselves through at the staff from January through March of 2010. So that's the timeline that gets you through the different steps so that this program could potentially be up and running by September 15th for the first offering, and consideration then to January to March.
Is that the last one?
Yes.
Leave that one up there. That's important. So Jeff, our name is correct. That's it on the timeline. Okay, so thank you for bringing us up to speed. I hope everyone's comfortable with the steps that are being taken, and I'm glad that Eileen and Jeff were able to share with us what their thoughts were on this. And now, of course, all the board members know that they need to examine this information, they need to think about it, and then anticipate in a month or so when the board or when the staff can put together the comments that are coming in from the public. At that point, they'll get them out to the board members, and we can use that in our deliberations also. Now, one thing that when I met with Eileen and Tom last week to talk about the next matter of weeks and months, the question came up about what would we hope to accomplish in July at a board meeting there. Knowing now the way the timeline fleshes out, nothing really is going to trigger in the next 4 weeks that would cause us to have to meet. And then also weighing in on it is the placement of the first week of July with the holiday on the end of the week there, and the board meeting would have been prior, 2 days prior to that holiday. So what I think is, I think I'm going to cancel the July meeting, but now we see a need for possibly one of our committees to step up. I think if the policy committee were able to think about having a meeting, probably July would be a good time for them to meet, and we could you could start fleshing out one of the topics that came up today with the hardship. Let's start thinking about how the board should treat that. So our work can continue. I hope people agree with me on how we should treat the month of July, though. Is there any comments on that? Just the suggestion then to have a policy committee meeting on the date.
I'll let the staff in you work that out on what the best date would be. I think there's flexibility in that. I don't know the reason
for that.
Yeah, we'd want to take action quickly so that we can get some public notice on that. But you may want to check availability before you. If your point was to use this moment right now to, for me to mention it so that it is noticed, I think first maybe have Paula reach check availability. Okay. And plus the staff might say, well, you know what, if we're going to have a meeting, let's cover a couple issues besides examining hardship criteria. I mean, there might be a couple things, so if we can give them a little time to do a little background, make the time as efficient as possible.
Not that I'm looking for excuses for more meetings, and I'd like to come to any subcommittee meeting on this. Maybe it's the fact that I don't know you all as well as we know each other or something, but I think the board would benefit from some thorough discussion among the whole board about these issues. I just, from my years of experience, it seems that the best decisions get made when you have a rather full exchange of ideas and thoughts and perspective, and really kind of hunker down on what we think collectively. I think, as a staff person, to try to assimilate your comments, public comments into something cohesive, I think is a very difficult job. And I think we should be giving more direction to the staff and what we want to accomplish, and then their job is to figure out how to best do that. So, I mean, I think I could have spent 2 hours today just talking about this draft of these procedures, because I think they're critical to how the the success is going to be. And it sounds like we're heading really quickly towards a one more, like the next meeting of this full board wanting to adopt these things. And I don't think it's enough time to be talking about it.
Well, I came from an environment before I was a member of the Hunts. I came from a town where everything, all the dirty laundry, all the discussion took place in a public format. And I guess even for myself, I learned when I came to the Hunts Council, things are done a little differently. They are not making a statement of whether it's the right way, the wrong way, the good or the bad. But I think, and not to put words in the statement, I think they appreciate when the comments are given to them so they can do their homework before they come back with an answer. Not that they don't want to be faced with a question or a comment. And I think you're also saying you'd like just members to kind of free form the discussion a little bit, which I'm not against. I mean, if you want to bring anything up at any time, I don't object till I, you know.
I think there's a lot to be given to people sitting around and talking about it versus emails here and there. It is my view.
In a formal setting.
I know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm open. Is the director saying that they'd like to have the July meeting anyways and come and just work through the document a little bit, the procedures a little more? I'm okay. I mean, I have no plans for going away right then. It was just we were looking at what would we have on the agenda. It would be kind of an open agenda, just a work session, which I'm fine with. I mean, we can meet same date. We didn't print out the room.
Does the timing
work? It's Thursday, July 2nd at 1 o'clock.
The timing works in terms of closing the comment period, having all the comments to consider and share.
So we're diligently to the
I wouldn't share.
But that's a good point that everyone should be aware of. Ted brought up a point about could it be an open to the public or closed meeting. We have a quorum, we're open to the public.
I might suggest completely self-meeting after the forum. I think a lot of people are taking advantage of that short week.
That's exactly what triggered the discussion about the need for it. And with the holiday and what work can be, if there was work that needed to happen that day, we forget the holiday. But it's the holiday based on also knowing where we are in our work efforts.
I can tell you one thing, it would help us if you could say if you wanted July 2nd and see how many people are available, because the most difficult thing for us ever to do is to try to set a meeting date, because you've no idea from that. And even it's a nightmare. Generally speaking, it's like 2 weeks of Paula's time. So if and we've already noticed July 2nd, everybody's right. Aware of it. If that works for the majority,
I think my blanket question to the board is should we have the July 2nd meeting? If not, then we're going to August.
Prefer the 9th.
Anyone other than Ralph? Okay. Well, let's keep it at the second. We're noticed for that. Okay, so we have a date certain for our next meeting, which is still July 2nd. The board, I guess, would like a work session environment. I would ask anyone in specific, or are we just going to talk through the procedures again? Bank procedures, is there anything else? And maybe instead of having the policy committee, maybe we'll work through that also. Why don't we put that in?
I mean, in terms of an agenda for that meeting?
Right.
I think we take it off of this meeting.
Right.
Put on the agenda.
But we won't
need the criteria. And we'll
have the same discussion that the policy committee would be having. We'll act as a committee of the whole.
We'll be reviewing a revised draft.
Yeah.
With public comment.
I mean, by July 2nd, could we? Would we? Will we have another meeting?
We'll have all the public comments. How much Jeff will have it condensed? I want to speak for him because I know he's all.
To the point where we get to a revised document.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great.
Yeah. Okay. And we'll look at the comments. Depending on the number of comments, the ability to condense them may be limited, but we'll share them with you all. Okay. So you have them.
That would be the only thing that would push me to go past that date, because that wasn't ready with the public comments. It wouldn't make sense to.
We'll have all the public comments. We may highlight them or something. We'll do our best to have them in a form that's at least somewhat more accessible to you.
Okay, great.
Before I open it up to the public, is there any other comments from any board members?
Just one more. You didn't really talk about this today, but this, the TDR program restrictions, Eileen, you made reference to it. They're very important documents also, and I know I have lots of comments on that. I wonder whether, is this board going to have a conversation about the contents of them, or independently submitting comments to the Highlands Council, or what? I think the issue for me that's central to those documents is whether or not the proper incentive is being created for people to give up their exemptions, which I think is a big priority right for the Highlands Council. They want those exemptions to go away. And so that's my concern for the documents. I just think it's kind of central to what we're going to be doing, and I think this board should have some thoughts on that.
You could discuss that at that work session as well, and then have the bank board comments go to the council, you know, from you as a group.
I think that would be great.
That's a good point. I was going to recommend just go directly to Eileen, which would carry a little, and Tom and Jeff, which would carry a little more weight, which would say 10%.
Chair, apologize for being a bit late, particularly since I wanted to ask you a question on procedure prior to the meeting and didn't get here in time. I went the wrong way, I went to Martha. I used to live here.
Just
automatically went to high school. To move the board into executive session for the purpose of attorney-client privilege, what our procedure is on that, is that something you want to know ahead of time? Is it something we can move at any time? Boards have different practices on that.
We have it on the agenda if deemed necessary. The only example requirement is that you provide the basis for going to executive session prior to doing so.
Yeah, I'd like to move the board going to executive session for the purpose of attorney-client privilege.
Would we do that after public comments, the way it is on the agenda?
It's the agenda.
It's courteous, yeah. We'll people later on. Yeah.
Okay. Although we still come out and come back right. Unless it's a public restoration.
Come back to order. Any other comments before I open it up to the public? Is there any member of the public would like to address the board? State's name for the record. We'll get that on in a minute then.
Helen Heinrich, New Jersey Farm Bureau. I'm very glad that you're going to take another meeting to really hash out some of these details because it is a very complex and important document which is going to govern how this whole program works. And so on July 2nd, I hope you mean that we can at least watch. Okay. I think I'm very concerned that with the conservation restrictions, I didn't see in your schedule that you were going to talk about, really look closely at those before it goes to the Highlands Council for discussion and approval. And looking at your schedule, somehow there's no time for you to do that unless you do it July 2nd. And if that's the case, maybe you need an all-day meeting on July 2nd. Because there's a lot in those documents that is critical. So am I correct in the way I'm interpreting your schedule?
My understanding was that the board is directing us to do it July 2nd. That it was going to be on the agenda. That's my understanding.
The covenant period for the conservation language closes the 3rd, right? July 2nd.
Right.
July 3rd.
For the operating procedures, it's the 26th.
Right, but hopefully you'd have, you know, most of our comments by that time. We will try not to do them at the very last 12th hour in this case.
Well, then we weren't going to take action on July
no.
2nd. That would just be our another bite at discussing the comments that have come in at that point that the staff was able to consider.
We would have the comments ready for you on
on the operating procedures, the comments on the conservation restriction go to the council. And so you would not have those ready and would not...
Right.
Your comments would be part of those comments going to the council.
Correct.
So it goes to the Highlands Council without a decision by you all whether you want that draft to go?
We're not making a decision.
Your comments on
our
conservation
comments. I'll be just that, comments from a board
to the Highlands Council.
Okay, right. So you'll be submitting comments to them about it. Okay, that's good. We will have some comments for you on the operating procedures. We're interested in your questions here today. We have a lot of the same questions, and it sounds like you're going to work on some of those points, but they won't really go online until after you've revised it and discussed it on the second.
Right.
Okay. And I guess I hope we should, even though you're using the PDCs as a model, as Susan pointed out, that has not been a very successful program until very recently. So let's be very careful that we don't just incorporate the PDC language without considering, you know, how it did work down there, because as Susan has pointed out, we don't even have any designated receiving areas to make the market for these. So thank you.
Any other member of the public wish to speak?
Julia Summers, New Jersey Highlands Coalition, and just a couple of questions. It wasn't clear to me when you were talking about the RFQs if you were looking for one firm or possibly as many as three firms.
I don't know the answer either.
One firm.
Okay.
The planning firm.
I heard the way you were phrasing it, and I understand why you'd be questioning that.
Okay. And I just wanted a clarification on which towns. You said there are five towns that currently have feasibility grants, and Long Hill is also considering it. So if it said yes, it would be a sixth. You mentioned Hopatcong. The others are?
Borough of Chester, Washington Borough, Warren County, City of Clifton, Hopatcong Township,
and Hopatcong, you said?
No.
It is.
Chester.
Hopatcong, Chester, Washington, Clifton.
Oh, and town of Clinton.
Town of Clinton. Okay. Thank you. That's all I have.
Any other member of the public wish to speak? Hearing none, I'm going to close the public portion. Any other board member who would like to make any comments before we adjourn?
Oh, I'm sorry. That's right. Wasn't a second though.
For executive session?
Yeah. We should make a motion that second.
I'm sorry. A motion to go into executive session.
I move, but
okay. A motion and a second to go into executive session.
The purpose being for attorney-client privileged
communication. Okay. Clear the room, please. Okay. So at this point, I'd like to accept the motion.
Wait a second. Sorry.
Can I have a motion to come out of executive session?
So moved.
A second?
Sorry.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, we're out of executive session.
And just report out that there was an executive session with the attorney-client privilege communication regarding the scope of the Highlands Act and the Garden State Preservation Trust.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments, board members, before we adjourn? Motion to adjourn?
So moved. Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Thank you.
Thank you.